Have a question or need how-to advice? Just ask Meta AI. Whether you need to summarize your class notes or want to create a recipe with the ingredients you already have in your fridge, Meta AI has the answers. You can also research topics, explore interests, and so much more. It's the most advanced AI at your fingertips. Expand your world with Meta AI. Now on Instagram, WhatsApp, Facebook, and Messenger.
You're listening to a Hindustan Times podcast, brought to you by HT Smartcast.
Hi, this is Manjula Narayan, National Books Editor, Hindustan Times, and this is the Books and Authors podcast. It's a weekly podcast where I speak to authors who've got a new book out. Hi, so today we have with us Upinder Singh, who's written A History of Ancient and Early Medieval India from the Stone Age to the 12th Century. You know, I mean, I'm always amazed by the bravery of historians, you know, so because this is such a massive period, right? And this is the second edition of this book. I'm just looking at it and I'm thinking, you know, can I even have a conversation with you about this? It seems, even having the conversation seems very ambitious. So, you know, tell me about doing this. I mean, it's clearly the labor of many years, you know, an entire lifetime, actually. So,
yeah, that's true, Manjula. Sometimes when I look at the book, I also think, oh, my God, you know, how did I do it? Why did I do it? There is a good answer to that. You know, I was a college teacher for over two decades in St. Stephen's College. And year after year, I taught my students a course on the history of India from prehistory to the, well, it went up to the 8th century sometimes and sometimes later. And I felt I needed to write something that would put things together in a way that students would find intelligible, would find interesting. There were a lot of dissatisfactions that I had as far as the writing of ancient Indian history goes. And I felt that the best way of addressing those dissatisfactions, doing something meaningful about them, was to move outside my room and to write. So I wrote this book. I sort of had to write it because there was, in a sense, it emerged very naturally from my experience of teaching students in the classroom. And then, of course, you know, those who have taught undergraduate students, especially courses in Delhi University, would know that you have to cover an enormous amount of material, enormous spans of time, and you have to bring to the classroom all that you have understood and all the insights that you have gained. And also you have to spark an interest in your students. So teaching undergraduates is very challenging. And I think many of the features you see in this book really emerge from that experience. At the same time, I must say that when I thought about this book, I really wanted to simultaneously address two audiences. One was the student audience, which was very important for me. And then I also wanted to simultaneously address general readers, because I felt there was a real need for a book on the history of ancient India across the centuries that brought ancient history alive, at the same time being rigorous and being very, very kind of careful in its presentation of data, in its analysis. And there really was a kind of overlap in what I perceive to be the needs of students and the needs of general readers.
And, you know, also the thing is that now history is so, there's so many different perspectives on Indian history, and everybody seems to think that theirs is valid, and that, you know, even the common person making a reel thinks he's a historian and will, you know, say all sorts of things. So in such, maybe this is always true, but it seems to become like people seem to think they're experts more nowadays. So that sort of general reader, what do you think they would take from this book? You know?
Well, history has, I think, always been political.
Yes.
And ordinary people, it's not like chemistry or, other disciplines in the sciences where a certain amount of expertise is required in order to have an opinion. People have opinions about history and they're entitled to have those opinions. But one of the things I wanted to show in this book is that there is a difference between having opinions about history and what the historian's job is. So I wanted to explain the historian's craft to readers. I wanted to expose them to the excitement and also to the complexities of primary sources. Any ancient Indian text you pick up, you have to understand that it is not telling a simple story. It's a very, very complex work, and you have to take into account the time in which it was written, the audience for whom it was written, the tradition that it belongs to. So understanding sources of various kinds. I tried to explain how sources can be understood in all their complexity to students. And I also wanted to convey to readers that history involves a very rigorous analysis of primary sources. It involves reasoned argument. And I do think that whether it is a student or a general reader, having gone through this book, I hope they will have discovered the sheer or experience, the sheer joy of excitement that reading about history can bring to us. And I also hope that they understand the historian's craft and the basis on which historical arguments are made. And I hope they go away with a general sense of how to distinguish between historical theories that have a good, strong basis in terms of the evidence and the arguments, and theories that are actually not history, but pseudo history or some kind of fanciful interpretation of the past.
And isn't the historian also always kind of struggling? I mean, at least in, I don't know, struggling against. I mean, I don't want to say things like an honest historian, no, because it's like you've mentioned, it's always perspectives, right? And it, at one point, one perspective might hold the upper hand, and the other, at another point, it's a different one, and it's a constantly changing thing, right? So, as a practicing historian who's always thinking about these things, how do you work it out? Like you've mentioned the nationalist historians, and then the leftist historians who came after that, and now you've mentioned about how there's more of a focus on women and people who were ignored, and going forward maybe even gender will, I mean, it won't be looked at as black, just male or female, as we go forward. So these things keep changing, right? The perspective and the focus keep changing. So as a practicing contemporary historian, how do you deal with that,
Well, Manjula, first of all, as a historian, you have to be really aware of what other historians are writing, and you absorb their insights. You learn from other historians. You learn from other perspectives and approaches to the past. But I think one of the things I really wanted to convey in my discussion of what you have talked about, that is the history of history writing,
Yes.
historiography, that there's been so much, there have been many changes in the ways in which historians have thought about the past and written about the past. And the important thing is not to get trapped in any particular straight jacket. I think it's really important, especially for young readers, students, and even general readers, to realize that while we must read histories produced by different historians who have different perspectives on the past, it's very important not to get trapped in any particular ideological framework. For me, it's important to be able to move beyond them. And there have been changes. You mentioned the incorporation, the attention that has been paid over many generations now towards the history of marginalized and subordinated groups. I
Yes.
think we've come a long way in the writing of Indian history now, looking at gender, looking at women, looking at the various class and caste groups that have been kind of considered as lower in the social hierarchy. All these have really become part of our understanding of social history. And there are other, you know, issues that this particular book takes up. And I should mention that this is the second edition of a book that was initially published in 2008.
Yes.
So when I first wrote that book, I had some very clear agendas. And this, I'd like to kind of address the question you asked about balance and perspective. As a historian who's writing a book for students or general readers, I feel I have to maintain a balance and at the same time, present my perspective or present a perspective which then readers can gauge and judge whether this makes sense or not. So for instance, when I wrote the book, in the one that was published in 2008, I wanted to integrate archaeology and history. I wanted to include subordinated and marginalized groups in my account or narrative of social history. I wanted to underline the importance of religion and philosophy and art in the history of ancient India. I wanted to be sensitive and to convey a sensitivity to readers of the importance of the intellectual domain, the creative, the artistic, the literary domains. So I wanted to do all that. But I wanted to do it in a way in which a window was opened, was kept open for readers to understand what I was trying to say, to understand the different theories that I was talking about, to understand the debates and be able to make up their own mind about, you know, which of these different theories make sense, which of these different approaches make sense.
Yeah, I was also thinking, and you made a mention of it, between 2008 and 2024, I mean, it feels like, it's a different world entirely. I mean, technology has progressed so much. And you've mentioned here also the, research on the human genome and on archaeology and the methods. I mean, there are so many things, even in everyday life now, that were unheard of, even in 2008. It doesn't seem so far away. But in terms of like the difference, it's huge. Even we could never have been speaking to each other like this in 2008, right? You know, talk about that. So,
Yeah, absolutely, Manjula. So much has changed since 2008 in the, not only in history, in the whole world.
Yes.
And also my own perspectives have changed. I've grown as a historian. My interests have broadened. So in the new edition, I had to bring together all these things, changes in the discipline of history, the new discoveries and techniques being used in archaeology, new research, new discoveries, and also new approaches. And some of these are now things that are very dear to my heart. For instance, I've become more and more interested in the history of ideas. Because of the work I did on political violence.
Yes.
That's a book that came out a few years ago, Political Violence in Ancient India. And that really got me immersed in the exciting world of intellectual history. And you will see some of that reflected here, the importance of the history of ideas. I've talked about the history of the importance of the forest.
Yes.
And forest people in
Yes.
Indian political history. My interest in visual sources has also grown enormously. I've always been interested in art, especially ancient art, not only of India, but other parts of the world. But I think it's really important for readers and for people in general to understand that art is not only part of art history, it is a very important source of history. And a work of art can express more than what can be expressed in words. So the emphasis on visual sources is much greater. There are hundreds of images, photographs and drawings and maps in the first edition. There are even more in this edition. Another thing that is different in this edition is that, you know, we all know that when we talk about Indian history, there are certain parts of the subcontinent that are not adequately represented.
Yes.
So for instance, in classroom, I've always had students from the Northeast saying, why is it that our part of the country doesn't make it to the history books? And what I tried to do, especially in the early chapters, was to consciously look out for material on
the regions of the Northeast. I consciously tried to look for material on Kashmir, so neglected areas of India. I tried to insert, enough into the book so that they would flag, they would represent, they would draw attention to the importance of these parts of the country. And I also looked at South Asia beyond India. And a lot of this has to do, by the way, a lot of that you see in the book has to do with my own discovery of history through my travels. So you will see the photographs that some of the photographs in the book represent the photographs I took in my travels across India, in my travels to Sri Lanka or various parts of Southeast Asia. And that's another new thing. I really feel very strongly that we have to look at Indian history, ancient Indian history, within a global context, not just India, but the larger subcontinent, not just the subcontinent, but the many different ways in which the subcontinent was connected to other parts of Asia, Europe, Africa over the centuries. So there's much more on that. And there's also more on than there was in the first edition on Islam, because and the Arabs and the early Delhi Sultanate. Because I feel very strongly that it's really a mistake to divide history up on the basis of religious divisions, basis of the religious affiliations of some ruling elites. And there's a very old-fashioned division of Indian history that the British really came up with into the Hindu period, the Muslim period, and the British period, which is actually not logic based on logic, because it was Hindu, Muslim, the third period, not Christian. And I think it's in our times, it's very important to recognize that Islam is also an important part of Indian history. It becomes an important part of Indian history. So it's not just Buddhism and Jainism and Hinduism and all those other religious kind of systems, but at a certain point of time, from the 8th century onwards, we see Muslim communities, we see a kind of cosmopolitanism in the kind of the settlements that came up, especially settlements related to trade on the western coast. And I think that it's important for readers of ancient Indian history to recognize that India has always been a center of not just influence, that's what everybody talks about, Indian influence on other parts of the world, but I see it as part, as the part of the story is also a story of confluence. And across the centuries, we've seen so many different cultural elements come together in different ways in different parts of the subcontinent. So some of these ideas, I was very keen that they should be part of this history. It's not just Islam, the early Jewish communities, the early Christian communities, the Zoroastrian communities that found a home, that made a home for themselves in India. All that is part of our cultural heritage.
Also, this it made me while I was going through the book, it made me think of if Raja Ram Mohan Roy was the first person to use like a term like Hinduism, and then if you're like splitting it into the Hindu period and the Islamic period and the British period, what it doesn't make much sense, because I mean the Hindu period, so then it's so anachronistic, right? Because if I mean, I'm not a historian, but this just made me think of that because there are so many streams of thought that might have been, very vibrant during the so-called Hindu period, and those that I think in our last conversation I vaguely remember we spoke about the many religious streams that died out as well, right? Which were flourishing during that period.
Yes, you're right. When we use labels, they always involve oversimplifying things. But labels should make sense. They should be logical. When you label an entire, many, many centuries of Indian history in a certain way, it should make sense. And there should be a consistency in the labeling. That's why I said that if you're going to pick on the religious affiliations of certain elite groups as the basis of labeling Indian history, then why is the third period not the Christian period? Why is it called the British period? And apart from that, you know, one can ask many questions. What is this Hindu period? Does Ashok, with his strong association with Buddhism, he falls within the falls within the Hindu period? What about the fact that in the so-called medieval, or if you want to call it Muslim period, what about the Cholas?
Yes.
How do they fit in with Muslim period? How does the Vijayanagara empire fit into the Muslim period? So there's a problem there. And certainly, even in the, what we call, again, for the sake of convenience, ancient India, there are just so many different trends and strands of religious ideas and practices. And I've gone back, I mean, leaving aside what we see in the prehistoric period or in the Harappan civilization, if you look at the historical period, we have the worship of Nagas and Nagis, Yakshas and Yakshis. And it was probably the worship of these beings that formed the basis of bhakti in the Indian traditions. Then you have Jainism and Buddhism, and Jainism and Buddhism are just two of many different philosophical schools that became religions, organized religions. There were so many other thinkers who were around in the Ganga Valley with very different philosophical views on the meaning of life, on human existence, so on and so forth, that were there. And even when we go further forward, you see the development within what we later came to call Hinduism. There's Vaishnavism, Shaivism, Shaktism. There's so much variety in the Indian, across and within the many different Indian, ancient Indian religious traditions. And it's important to realize that. It's not a simple story.
And you know what also struck me is that the sections where you speak about about language, you know, about the written script and how far back that appeared in India, you know. So let's talk about that, you know, and about not just the Harappan, but then you mentioned also the Brahmi script, and you know how now the idea is that it's even further back than what was thought before, right? Fourth century CE and all that, BCE. So,
yes, that's very important, because the invention of writing has two important aspects. One is that the creation of a script and the production of texts, written texts, marks a very important stage in human organization and experience, and has all kinds of social and political and economic implications. And the other thing is that once writing is invented, it opens up a new kind of source material for historians. So writing has a twofold importance, both for the people who learn the art of writing, and reading and writing, and also for historians, who can then use that written material in order to reconstruct the past. In the case of India, of course, the situation is a little complicated, because writing was first invented in the third millennium BCE, okay, in the Harappan civilization. Yeah. And one of the big mysteries in as far as the Harappan civilization is concerned, of course, our knowledge about the civilization has increased enormously, but the Harappan script is not so far deciphered.
Yes.
So they were literate people, and their writing is largely found on seals and sealings. You don't have very long text, but it would really be great if we could read the writing on those seals. So right now we can't. So it's a literate culture that produced written material, but we can't read that material, and we can't use that written material in order to find out more about the Harappan civilization. And then after the Harappan civilization declines, you know, from around 1900 BCE onwards, writing seems to have disappeared. More or less. I mean, then it reappears. It reappears much later. And you're quite right. Till recently, it was thought that writing, I mean, the actual specimens of writing that appear in after the decline of the Harappan civilization, when you come to the Mauryan period, Ashok's inscriptions, okay, that is the third century BCE. That's when you get all these inscriptions inscribed on rocks and pillars. And, they form a major source of information on Ashok and his ideas of Dhamma and
Yes.
kingship. But in recent decades, and even at that time, Manjula, the point was that writing, one assumed that although writing on stone appeared as a royal practice in Ashok's time, historians did assume that it may have been known even earlier, several centuries earlier. It's just that things were written on perishable,
Yes.
perishable surfaces. So it could be, on palm leaf or some other material that has perished. But there, in recent decades, there's been evidence from Sri Lanka, from the site of Anuradhapura, where writing has been found in a pre-Mauryan context, going back to the 4th century BCE or earlier. And then various sites in South India, such as Kodumanal, for instance, where writing again has been found in what seems to be a pre-Mauryan context. Now, that has a lot of implications for our understanding of the history of writing in the historical period in India. And how do we make sense of it? I think there's going to be more evidence that will come out that may force us to change some of our views about the issue of writing in India. Right now, at present, what it seems is that the earliest evidence of writing, but that is writing on pottery, okay? We're not talking about long inscriptions. We're talking about
Yes.
letters incised on fragments of pottery. These have come from various sites in South India, such as Kodumanal, Anuradhapura in Sri Lanka, suggesting that writing was known in various parts of the South in the 4th century, certainly the 4th century BCE. Of course, the dates are also contested and debated,
Yes.
but I think 4th century BCE, certainly it's known before Ashok. But Ashok produces the first permanent records, inscribed records, writing on stone, the production of large volumes of written material, inscribed material on stone. That really happens in Ashok's time, in the 3rd century BCE.
So really, like, if there's a vast desert between the Harappans in writing, between the Harappans and then what comes later, it's probably just because of perishable objects used as material, right? Could be.
To some extent,
Or
yes,
could it
that
be that people just forgot to write? I mean, could it be? I was just wondering, can literate societies just suddenly give up on it? It seems a bit frightening and strange as
yeah,
well.
you're right. It does seem strange. I mean, but just think about the fact that cities also disappear.
That's true.
States
Yeah.
seem to have disappeared. So, these three things, writing, cities, and states, tend to go hand in hand with each other, across cultures, across the histories of different parts of the world. So, the Harappan civilization was an urban civilization. It was a literate civilization. It was a civilization that had a script,
Yes.
which knew writing, which used writing. And then, with the decline of city life, you find there is a kind of a decline in many other urban features, and writing seems to be part of that story. So there's a kind of, it is curious, isn't it, that there's a process of de-urbanization that sets in. And you have the cities gradually, some of them gradually decline, some of them are suddenly abandoned. And there's a kind of the civilization, there's a kind of, it's not as though nothing existed after that. You do have many village communities in different parts of the country. So it's not as though it's a blank. There is archaeology to help us fill in the gap between the decline of the Harappan civilization and the emergence of cities in the 6th century BCE. But when cities emerge in around the 6th century BCE, and that's the age of, just for listeners to be able to place it, the age of Mahavir and the Buddha, that's the 6th century BCE, that's when you have cities and states emerging. And one can assume that writing was also known and used then. But we don't have any hard evidence for that. We don't have actual specimens of writing during that period. That only comes really, with the evidence from Kodumanal. By the way, that's Tamil Brahmi, okay, the script that is found at sites in the far south. And Ashok's inscriptions are, most of them are in the Brahmi script. And in the northwest, you have the use of the Kharoshthi script. And most of Ashok's inscriptions are in the Prakrit language. And in the northwest, we have the use of Greek and Aramaic. So just to map out some of the languages and the scripts that we see.
So it was as complex back then. I mean, I linguistically, I guess, right? Even
Yes, I mean, think of the Indian map today. How many languages and dialects do we have across the century? And there is so many. And one can assume that although most of Ashok's inscriptions were in the Prakrit language, that there must have been so many different languages and dialects that spoken across the subcontinent. He used multiple languages and scripts in the Northwest. And to my mind, that is something that ties in with what we know about some of the other great ancient empires. For instance, if you take the Persian Empire, the Achaemenid Empire, that was multilingual. And you have the kings such as Darius or Dariavaush and using different languages and scripts in their inscriptions. So one can actually try to connect the practices of the Mauryas with the practices that we see in some of the earlier and then contemporary empires. So that's what I mean. We need to look at Indian history, whether it is of the Mauryan period or whether it is of earlier or later periods, in a larger geographical frame to see what was happening in other parts of the world and how what was going on in India connected with, was similar to, or was very different from what we see in other parts of the world.
About, I was asking you about the forest, the archaeology, and the forest as part of history, trade and all that, which I don't know, generally one doesn't think about, but clearly, obviously, they were, it was very integrated. And when you mention about those rest, sort of sarais within the forest, and with I was quite fascinated to think about these people. And there were keepers of the sarai as well, right? I mean, of course, it wasn't called the sarai, something else, but a guest house generally within the forest for passing tradespeople, traders. So, let's talk about that and why has the forest not been part of more studied as, part of our history?
Well, Manjula, there are various reasons why we haven't paid enough attention to the forest. I think that is because very often the historian's gaze is directed towards kingdoms, empires, cities, river valleys where agriculture is being practiced. And these have traditionally been the focus of historians' attention, although that has changed quite a bit, particularly when we look at the history of modern India. But it's important to remember that the really massive forest clearance in India took place from the 1830s onwards, when the British launched a massive program of railway construction. Until then, and that involved massive forest clearance, till then, vast tracts of land across different parts of the country, the subcontinent, were forested and they were inhabited by forest people. So what I've argued, and I argued this in my Political Violence in Ancient India in considerable detail, where I have a whole chapter on the wilderness, but I did try to also bring some of that discussion into A History of Ancient and Early Medieval India, which is the book that we are discussing. I've made the point there that the forest is the single most underestimated element in the political history of ancient India. And the reason for this, apart from the lack of interest of historians, is that forest tribes did not produce written sources. So everything that we can know about them comes from sources that were produced by states, by urban cultures, by elites belonging to urban cultures, to kingdoms, so on and so forth. So once you realize that the forest is extremely important, not only politically, but also in trade, I mean, think of all the different kinds of materials that were provided by forests. Think of elephants that were so important in ancient Indian armies. Think
Yes.
about ivory, wood, various kinds of mineral resources that were located in forested people. You realize that the forest is really and something that is very, very central to understanding Indian history, including ancient Indian history. And once you realize that and you start looking at the sources, you find that actually ancient sources have a great deal to say about the forest and the forest people. Just think, Manjula, think about the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. Think
yes,
about
yes.
all those years that the protagonists of the epics spend in exile. And the forest
yes.
is many things in ancient texts. It's a place of exile. It's a place of natural beauty. It's a place where you see the burgeoning of romance and love.
Yes.
I'm thinking of Kalidasa's Abhijana Shakuntalam. It's a place inhabited by demons. It's a place where rishis have their ashramas.
Yes.
So the forest is many things. And ancient texts actually have a lot to say about the forest. One of the texts that says a lot of very interesting things about the forest is Kautilya's Arthashastra. He classifies forests into different types. He recognizes that forests are a very, very important economic and military resource for kings. And as I said, the dependence of states, of kings, of kingdoms on the forests, that is something that really is an issue that we need to think about. The importance not only of woods and metals and minerals and such things, but the importance of elephants, which were one of very important elements in ancient Indian armies.
Yes.
At the same time, you know, we need to think about the relationship between kingdoms and forests in a as something that have many different facets. So forests were an important resource for kingdoms, economic and otherwise. They were also a source of perennial trouble for kings. And the best example of this is the 13th Rock Edict of the Emperor Ashok, who is known for his pursuit of Dhamma, which I would understand as goodness and virtue, and his attempts to propagate Dhamma all over his empire and even beyond it. The 13th Rock Edict is that very famous inscription in which Ashok talks about the Kalinga War, which he says happened 8 years after he had been consecrated, and thousands of people were killed and injured and deported. And in that inscription, Ashok announces that he's going to renounce war and he's not going to pursue war anymore. He's not going to pursue victory through war. He will pursue Dhamma Vijaya, which is victory achieved through propagating Dhamma,
yes,
goodness or virtue. And in that same inscription, in which this great emperor expresses great remorse at the death and devastation that this war in Kalinga had caused, and that in which he talks about and gives various reasoned arguments about why war in general is a very bad thing. Because I think Ashok was not only a ruler, he's also expressing a certain kind of political philosophy. In that same inscription, he goes on to give a very stern warning to the Atavikas, that is the forest people, telling them that the king will only forgive that which can be forgiven, and basically telling them to watch out and not create any trouble for him. So even for a king devoted to ahimsa and to non-violence, such a passionate advocate of non-violence, he was aware of the potential trouble that could be created by recalcitrant forest tribes, and warns them about this. So forest people were also a political challenge to ancient states. So that's what I mean by saying that they're a very underestimated aspect of ancient Indian political history. And they're underestimated because we don't know about them. They didn't leave inscriptions and texts. So everything we know about them comes from the texts and inscriptions of that come from kingdoms and from urban societies.
And I found even the, you know, the elephant section very interesting in that, I mean, one doesn't think about elephant, how ancient India didn't rear elephants, but they were like caught as adults. You know, that was, and then you make that point that, you know, so clearly there must have been so a whole industry revolving around catching elephants, adult elephants, not, you know, because they're not reared like cattle, but yet their status is very high, right? So all that was interesting. And also this bit about, you know, when you talk about the Anthropocene and how when we talk about railways and in the 1830s, the British started laying the tracks and destroying whole forests, you know. But you also mention how even things that we think of, we are constantly anxious about the Anthropocene and where we're heading with climate change and all that. But also the use of, you know, you make this point about the use of fire and, you know, all those discoveries. So clear, and how humanity has been impacting the environment forever, right? So you want to talk about that, you know?
Yes, I think we've become more conscious about the human impact on the environment, especially under the shadow of climate change. But there is this whole debate on the Anthropocene, and that is an age when human impact started causing major irreversible change in the environment. And there are differences of opinion about when this should be dated. But I do think, apart from that particular debate, it's important for any period of history to locate human activity within its larger environmental context. And so this goes back to, let's say, our understanding of Stone Age communities. You can't understand the experiences of Stone Age people unless you understand where they got the stone for making stone tools from, where they got water from, where they got the basis on which they subsisted. So whether it's animals that they hunted or whatever. So it's very important to situate human activity within that larger environmental context. Of course, when I just mentioned the fact that it's massive forest clearance that from the 1830s onwards that we see really significant depletion of forest cover, we should also recognize the fact that this is an ongoing process. And even in our own times, we know how many, that there's just so, that nature is so endangered. And we know, for instance, about the Aravallis being endangered, whether it is the building of roads or whether it is construction activity, mining activity, which is posing a very, very major threat, perhaps more than, what we see, significantly more of a threat than what we see in earlier times. So the degradation of nature is something that is very, very evident in our own time. And perhaps the heightened awareness that we have of the importance of conserving the environment is connected to the fact that the dangers to the environment have increased manifold in the last at least few decades. But in ancient history, I think you really need to factor the environment in. It's not just animals, it's also climate. We're talking about climate change, but there are theories about, you know, how and why did the Harappan civilization decline? Was there there's so many different theories about that. So was it floods in the case of Mohenjo-daro, or was it drought? Was it change in the coastline on the Makran coast? Was it increasing aridity? So all these aspects of the environment have a very important bearing on our understanding of settlement history, of the rise and fall of civilizations, and why certain areas become important agrarian centers. Trade routes also are affected by, are influenced and by geographical factors. So you can't really separate human history from the natural environment and the vicissitudes, the changes in the natural environment have had a very major role to play in human history across cultures.
And, you know, I also found this section, of course, this is the grand thing that one keeps discussing all the time. People, Indians are so interested in the origins of, you know, the origins of Indians, you know, and the migrations and the Aryan invasion theory that when I was in school, that was the thing that was taught to us. Like, you know, everybody ran away and they were like, the Aryans came in. And obviously now with, like you've mentioned, you know, it's completely, we don't think like that anymore. So let's talk about that, you know, and how new discoveries and going forward, like genetics is going to teach us so much more, right? So where do you think that stream will go, you know? Like, right, you mentioned here that it must be emphasized that there's no evidence of an Aryan invasion of northwestern India, nor of a massive wave of immigration. The evidence suggests a series of migrations of relatively small groups of people. Now, this is what we believe now. But as more evidence, what do you think? Where do you think? I mean, of course, this is just shooting in the dark, but, you know.
Yeah, so this is a subject that has excited interest not only among scholars, but also at the popular level for a very, very long time. You know, who were the Indo-Aryans? Where did they come from? Did they come from somewhere else? And there are so many different theories about the original home of the Indo-Aryan. Now, I think that that is not an, it's an important question because migration has always been part of human history. But, you know, this has become more than just an academic issue. It's also something that's highly politicized. Yes. It's connected ideas about who is an Indian, the whole issue of, you know, the original inhabitants, who are those who came from elsewhere. I think that the evidence today, as it currently stands, it comes from linguistics, it comes from archaeology, and it comes from genetics, from DNA analysis of ancient DNA. I think that does together, if you put the evidence from linguistics and archaeology and DNA analysis together, I think it does present a coherent story of migrations, successive waves of migrations into the subcontinent. And the many homelands that have been suggested for the Indo-Aryans, as far as that is concerned, you know, there is, I think, plenty of evidence to show that it was in Eastern Europe, you know, in the Black Sea area, that that's where these people originally came from. The roots of migration, the connections between Iran and India, and, the, you know, the different kind of roots, the timings and all that, these are things that we still need more details on. But the evidence does seem to hang together, suggesting not invasions. There's no massive Aryan invasion, but there are a series, or there were a series of migrations into the subcontinent. And actually, I don't think that this is not surprising at all, because if you think of the northwestern frontier, across the centuries, it has been a porous frontier, and you have so many different groups of people moving into the subcontinent, traders moving across the Hindu Kush. There are trade routes that connected northwestern India with parts of Central Asia and West Asia, so on and so forth. So movement across that frontier has been a regular part of Indian history, and migration has been an important part of human history. You know, you think of the out of Africa kind of, when we look at human evolution and the movement of groups of people, hominins across Africa and Asia, it's movement and migration, and that involves the mingling of people. And I think this whole idea that some people may have of searching for some kind of intrinsic, some pure origins. You know, there is often this idea about who are the original inhabitants and who are later immigrants. We're all, in a sense, the descendants of people who have been on the move, who have been migrants, and therefore it's an important realization that people should have, that migration and movement of people have been part of human history across the centuries, across the millennia, and it should not be. There's sufficient evidence to show that there were waves of Indo-Aryan migrations into northwestern India.
Mm-hmm. So now, you've done this massive book, and I mean, you've done this new edition of it. So are you working on something else now? Is it too soon or what?
No, it's not too soon. I mean, this book did take up a lot of time. The first edition took me about, I think, 5 years to kind of from start to publication, probably more than 5 years to write, I think. The second edition took less time, but it was a different kind of exercise. I had to really think hard about what I wanted to change, what I wanted to add. And again, that fine line between balance, a balanced approach, and at the same time being able to convey things that you think are important to readers. But I am, of course, thinking of what I want to do next, and I'm already doing it in a small way. I do hope that my next book talks about ancient India in a global context, because I'm now really tired of looking at the regions of the subcontinent and, you know, Indian history. I want to, and I love traveling. I want to travel in my work also. I want to talk about the connections between ancient India and Iran, connections between ancient India and Central Asia, which has been such an important part of Indian history or Eurasian history across the centuries. Connections with East Asia, Southeast Asia. So this is the direction in which my interests and ideas are moving. So hopefully, if all goes well, I would like to write a history of ancient India that takes a broader geographical context and presents early Indian history within a larger Eurasian context, bringing in Europe, Asia, and Africa.
Okay, that sounds, huge, you know, but I'm not surprised looking at this. Anyway, so for the listeners, go out and get a history of ancient and early medieval India from the Stone Age to the 12th century by Upinder Singh. It is a mammoth work, but it is, you can dip into it and, you know, it'll always give you something to, a lot to think about, actually. So thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you, Manjula. It's been fun talking to you. Bye.
Bye.
To stay updated on this podcast, follow us at HD Smartcast on all the major social media platforms. To listen to more such podcasts, log on to www.hdsmartcast.com.
Have a question or need how-to advice? Just ask Meta AI. Whether you want to design a marathon training program or you're curious what planets are visible in tonight's sky, Meta AI has the answers. It can also summarize your class notes, visualize your ideas, and so much more. It's the most advanced AI at your fingertips. Expand your world with Meta AI. Now on Instagram, WhatsApp, Facebook, and Messenger.